Lowe's knows how to help make your home holiday ready for less. Get Select Style Selections vinyl flooring for just $1.99 per square foot and have it installed before the festivities begin. Our team can help you every step of the way. See a Lowe's Red Vest associate or visit lowes.com/holiday install to get started. Lowe's, we help, you save. Basic install only. Date restrictions apply. Subject to availability. Install by independent contractor. See associate for details. Contiguous U.S. only.
Tell her what you did, Roger. You made out with some dude's husband, wife.
You're on a roll tonight, son. A little bit.
This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 316 of the Outlander podcast. I am still Ginger.
And I'm Shimmer, sometimes known as Summer. And we are in love with all things Outlander, even after 6 years. And now, on to the longest read-along in the history of read-alongs. This week we are covering close to 10 chapters, which means 8, but chapters, lots of chapters. But we are going to start this week with chapter 63 entitled The Surgeon's Book 1.
Most, if not all, of the chapters of tonight's episode that we're discussing start with some either, usually like some quote or excerpt from something. Most of the time, it's going to be from a journal of Governor Tryon's, but this one, I don't think it's from the journal. It's some instruction, an instruction for surgeons during battle, I guess, or war. Item 28, some instruction. And basically, it outlines that surgeons are to keep a book in which they enter the name, company, date of intake into care of someone who is wounded or has something going on, and then the date of release. So we're in Claire's POV this chapter. Claire has a quote-unquote vision of the angel of death passing her by. There's a feeling in the whole camp that something has happened, something is going on. Jamie is also, or still, experiencing tension.
And this is all prior to anything happening.
Yes.
And to be fair, I feel like we should have opened this whole episode with like trigger warning. I feel like I'm glad we didn't stop 2 chapters prior to when we stopped, because if that's where we called it for like 2 weeks, that would have been awful.
It might be triggering, who knows, but definitely is one of the times in one of the chapters later on. It's one of the times that I really don't need. And I know Summer normally would say, oh, did you stop talking about, you know, like, I don't have to read all the gore, all the guck, all the whatever.
No, but you do have to read all the sexy bits.
No,
all of them.
No, but I don't mind reading if something is graphic, but not sexy graphic. But if it's graphic, like, you know, like surgery, like, I don't mind that. To me, that's fascinating and whatever. However, in one of the chapters we get into here, Diana does some of her most descriptive writing. And I did not need to read it. I just was like, okay, got it. Not only do I know the story, I'm not taking notes on this. It's just we don't need to know all the stuff. I just described it really quickly. Without going into guilty.
I'll make that decision on our behalf.
Oh, no. I already did. A rider comes into view. It was Brianna. And she was accompanied by Joshua to cast his groom. Now, what's significant about this? Well, Brianna was in Hillsborough doing a commission, an artist commission. She was painting or drawing a portrait. She was not supposed to be here, her and Jem. So she shows up. So that's kind of funky town. Brianna had insisted on coming out to the field, to the war games. She has some serious words with Jamie. Jamie's like, what are you doing here, Biznatch? She turns and sees Claire and then smiles. She says that she'd heard that they were camped there and she brought some food along with her and some herbs that she thought her mom might be able to use. She says she hadn't come to fight, but that by gum, she's going to stay with Claire. She'll be safe as she can. She did not come to fight, but she will stay. And she says, quote, if there's nursing to be done afterward, I can help, unquote. So many things in so many chapters are so fortuitous. She asks, oh, by the way, where's Roger? That's what everyone wants to know. Claire tells her that Jamie had sent Roger across the creek to try to talk to Herman's husband, to try to get him to talk to the governor,
to do stupid that puts everyone in danger. That's what they sent Roger across the river to do.
Brianna is aghast. Jamie tries to convince her that he'll be back. He's safe. He's carrying a flag of truce.
Is he? That's not enough. Your flag of truce doesn't help him from making stupid decisions, because that's what he does. He makes stupid decisions.
Jamie continues to say that he'll be back. He'll be back. And he promises her, quote, he'll be all right.
He shouldn't have promised that. He will be back, but I can't promise you he'll be all right.
Claire explains to Bree about her instruments and of the convenience of the bag that she has with her medical instruments and herbs and everything. It's a bag so that she can, basically it's mobile, right? It's a mobile unit, medical unit. She can take it with her to someone who is wounded rather than, if there's a need, rather than wholly relying on people being brought to her. She can go to them if it's not easy or convenient or possible to move them. And she explains that Brianna notices that she smelled a smell, and she explains to Brianna that it's quite common for men, or I guess women, humans, to empty your bowels before a bladder. Before a bladder? Oh my God. Before a battle. Well, that's I guess you thing. Can poop before you pee. Claire asks Brianna, like, what were you saying to Jamie? Because they had some supposedly strong words that she didn't hear, but then, or a little bit she heard, but then they spoke in Gaelic and she did not understand that. She's like, what were you saying to Jamie? And Brianna says, Jamie had asked her if she'd intended to leave her son an orphan. And she'd replied to Jamie, do you plan on making me an orphan with my mom here?
Jamie, you. That's awful.
And it's on. An aide of Tryon's rides up and says to stand ready. There had been someone, a minister Caldwell, who come to speak for the other side, but Tryon had been unmoved. The regulators have an hour, or had at some point, an hour to disperse, or there would be battle. And they are to listen for the sound of the cannon fire. Thinking about her education, Bree says that because she never read anything about anything happening in North Carolina or about Alamance and nothing about a Governor Tryon, she's convinced, or maybe she's trying to convince herself, that there would be no large battle. Surely if there'd been something, she would have read about it. She's telling herself all of this to convince herself that Roger will be safe, or at least that he is in no danger from a big battle. Jamie is prepping for battle too. Claire goes to him and she has to say something to him before another battle begins, just in case they say another potential last goodbye. And he says, quote, there may come a day when you and I shall part again, but it will not be today, unquote. And a chapter ends with a bugle call.
What do you think that sounded like?
Stop it over here.
Like something like that? That's all I can hear in my head when you say bugle call. All right. Moving on to chapter 64, entitled Signal for Action.
So before we get started on this one, listener and commenter to come, Eugenia E., had a question about, and Summer's going to laugh at this probably, had a question about, the question was for me specifically, but Summer can definitely answer this as well, because maybe Summer and I have actually talked about this several times. The pronunciation of Bakli. See, I told you.
I mean, full disclosure, Davina didn't even know. She said it differently.
Well, she knew. She just knew it
she
twice.
She changed it between the two books. Because
she started with Bakli, right?
Bakli in the first one, and then he's Buckley later.
Well, what does first one mean in this one?
Yeah, Bakli.
Okay, so in book five, he's Bakli.
But I mean, we need to make a decision. Are we going to call him Galus, Gilus, or Duncan? So are we going to call him Buckley or Buckley? Or just William?
Well, he's never called Buckley that I've ever heard. He's called Buckley in this book. And then she may go back and forth. But I think in the next book, or later books, mm-hmm. not to spoil anything, she says, I'm not kidding, Buckley.
Mm-mm.
I promise you, she does. Buckley.
No. I feel like I need to download that book right now to prove you wrong.
Oh, no, I'm not wrong. We asked her in an interview, too. So,
Buckley?
100%.
None of those letters are right.
I call him Buck.
Are you going to call him Buck?
Yes.
Okay.
To answer Eugenia's question, she asked about the... She wasn't asking... She did mention Divina's pronunciation. Well, she asked about the pronunciation and she did mention Divina. But she... If I understand correctly, Eugenia, you were asking about... You were asking, how is it pronounced? And I... It probably was a combination of stress and pronunciation as far as, like, how does it sound, right? So... Buckley or Buckley, right? I don't think Eugenia was confused about the Lee or the book. I think she was confused about the Buckley, like where to put the stress. And yeah, if we saw it spelled differently, we definitely would say Buckley, wouldn't we? Because that's what, if I saw B-U-C-K-L-E-Y. But yeah, so you are not confused, Eugenia, that it sounds potentially a little different to our ears. And to make it even more interesting, as I was getting at or trying to get at, Divina uses Buckley, and then in a later book or books, I think she goes to Buckley back and forth, and then after a further book, again no spoilers, settles on Buckley. So this chapter 64, opens with a quote from, like I said, one of these written works, and this is from The Order of Battle. Written by Governor Tryon. Basically, he says that 3 cannon blasts are a signal to form a line of battle. 5 blasts mean action or attack or shoot. So we go from Jamie, Claire, and Brianna to Roger. He's walking slowly back from the regulator camp, making his way to the militia camp. He's walking slowly because he does not want to draw attention to himself. When he is out of sight of the camp that he left, he stops. He's sweaty and his heart's racing. He's trying to calm himself and he's thinking of his wife and child. Diana gives us his view. He's seeing her, or an image of her, is Bree in a doorway holding Jem. And he has, quote, a conviction of joy that soothed his mind and eased his soul, unquote. He knows about Reverend Caldwell, and he also knows that he was unsuccessful. So all the stuff that was reported to Jamie, or at least that we were let known through Claire's POV, or Jamie's talking about it in the last chapter, Roger's also aware of. Kate O. writes, every time I read this chapter, I always picture Roger slowly walking as fast as you can. We've all done this walk.
How do you do that? Slowly walk as fast as you can.
You need to be somewhere. You're running late, but also trying not to look like a complete lunatic while doing so. Roger's dizziness and shakiness and relief remind me a bit of myself when I get off stage. Before and in the moment, I'm just that, in the moment. The second I'm off stage, my hands are shaking like a fiend. Quote, his damp stock felt suddenly as though it would strangle him, unquote. During your first reading, you're blissfully unaware of how hard Diana is beating you over the head with foreshadowing. This gets me every time now, knowing how close we are to what's going to happen. Side note, the other moment that touches me is after they're married and he says that no matter what, he'll always sing for her.
Spoiler alert.
Roger is still experiencing, quote, that odd sense of awe that he was experiencing in that cabin with husband when they were praying. What he does arrive at is that, quote, if he hadn't meant to shoot anyone before, meaning as part of any war or battle, he could mean it still less now, unquote. Roger, it seems, has undergone a type of transformation that he's just beginning to unpack and deconstruct, trying to be able to understand it. He thinks on Jamie's loyalties, and he thinks that though he doesn't believe Jamie holds any loyalty to the crown, that he very well might hold loyalty to Tryon because of the land, the grant, and all of that. And as he's thinking about Jamie's fighting past as a mercenary, he begins to hear voices. It's women washing in a stream. And as he's looking out, he sees Morag. And he doesn't think, literally, because Diana writes.
Dumb.
Before,
he's dumb. He has no sense of self-preservation. Like,
it's not like there's a war on or anything.
And this whole freaking chapter just makes me so angry.
I know. Before he could stop himself, he went through his coverage of willows and walked toward the women. Again, he doesn't stop. He says hi to Morag. Now, she does recognize him. He takes some of her washing from her and walks away to get her to follow.
He steals her laundry.
I know.
And walks away with it. Don't make this any like more flowery than it is. He steals her and walks away. And she's like, what the F are you doing? Why are you taking my laundry? And she's forced to follow him. And everyone sees him do it, which yes. means everyone sees him.
And everyone can speak against him.
Thank you.
He has a lot of witnesses. That's what you're saying.
Yes, all of them.
He wants her to tell her husband and make them leave. What he says to her is because he knows, well, everyone knows there that it's potentially dangerous because they're all there for the battle, right? But he's like, look, you guys need to, he's a little, you know, personally invested here, which I understand. But yeah, I wasn't so smart. He's like, you and your husband need to leave before all this shiz goes down because y'all, it's going to be dangerous. And there's no way the regulators are going to beat the militia. It's just not going to happen. And he sees she's pregnant. Fun times. Mm-hmm. So Roger is right, quote, to bring both wife and child to war suggested that he, meaning Buccleuch, had no safe place to leave him, unquote. He is wondering, like, why in the hell are Morag and the baby here? Like, this makes no sense. Why do you bring your wife and child unless you have no other place for them to be safe?
Uh-huh.
Roger wants to tell her that if anything happens to them, come to Fraser's Ridge. Come to me. We will help take care of you. And then he kisses her gently.
Asshole. Like, seriously, that's not okay ever. Ever, ever, ever. That's not ever okay.
In any century. Nope.
Ever. Ever. And he did the same thing on the freaking boat, which pissed me off. I'm like, do you never learn? He nope. never learns. The point is, it's never okay.
We already agreed. You're yelling at me. I already said yes.
I am yelling at you because I'm so mad. I'm so mad at Roger.
You have time and even more stuff to get mad at. So just hold on to some of that.
I have lots of feelings.
Kate O writes, when he notes that Morag is still alive and his joy at it, I want to yell, move along, Roger. Move along.
Exactly. Be okay. Be okay with seeing her and being like, cool, she survived, which means I'm alive. We're good. Move on. Clearly, his being still alive is enough
for him to know that it's going to be okay.
Right. Yeah, exactly. As long as he's alive, he doesn't have to worry. She's fine.
Kate continues, you only have a 1-hour window, but no. Thus begins a series of completely questionable judgment calls on Roger's part. Questionable judgment call number one. Splashing across the shallow creek to talk to Morag while among a group of women eyeing him questioningly. You're in enemy territory, Roger. Questionable judgment call number two and three. Stealing her laundry? I mean, you're at a loss for words, so you grab her laundry and run away? And getting her alone? Oh, Roger. Poor, sweet, well-meaning, but stupid Roger. All the things he asked her, he could have asked in the company of the other women. The only thing that could be construed as sensitive is the information about the militia. But if he was trying to help, really, all of those women would have benefited from hearing this. And if they hadn't been alone, none of the stuff, him creeping her out, the slapstick return of the laundry. But of course, that's the point. And of course, he seals his fate with questionable judgment call number four, the kiss.
Number four. Jesus Christ. The fact that we get that far into his
quote unquote questionable judgment is the worst. Roger.
And the kiss happens, right? It shouldn't have, for many reasons. One, Morag should have been like, WTF, dude, get off my face. One. Two, Roger should have had a little bit of sense of self-preservation because her being there at all means that her husband is somewhere nearby. I'm like, nothing you do now will go unnoticed at all. Have a sense of self-preservation, damn it.
So that kiss was in front of her husband.
Seriously.
William Buckley McKenzie, whom
it
I will call
just
Buck,
gets worse. Oh my God.
Comes out of the bushes. My question is, how long has he been there? We don't even know.
Matter? He saw the only part that matters.
Roger now tries to backwalk that kiss.
Good luck.
It wasn't what you think.
You can't do that. That's not how that works.
And he says they hadn't seen each other's faces in the dark on the Gloriana. I don't know what that has to do with anything. Or maybe it was because Buck didn't recognize each other. And that was because they hadn't seen each other's faces on the Gloriana. But obviously, Roger recognized Morag, but he didn't recognize William because it was dark and they never were in the same area. Two other men, armed, of course, come out of the bushes. Buck says he'll deal with Roger. He tells his wife to go back to the women. Then, as Buck, with his fist clenched, moves toward Morag to get her to go on, Roger's like, you don't touch that woman, and he punches Buck. Then he hears a gun, or a pistol, whatever, cocked behind his head, and it goes off. But it must have misfired, because it doesn't hit him. Buck is still after him. The men are all after him. Fighting ensues as Buck heads toward Roger in waist-deep water. Cannon blasts are heard in the distance.
Good night.
Kate O. writes, "The entire scene bewildered me the first time I read it. Even ignorant of what was actually going to happen, I still felt like I was careening down a hill out of control towards whatever catastrophic event was going to happen. Why kiss her? And now, no matter how many times I read this part, Roger always seems a tad creepy and a little crazed, which maybe is his only excuse for all of this questionable behavior." The battle had begun. Yes, the fight between the militia and the regulators, and a huge personal, mental, and physical battle for Roger.
And that was chapter 64. Moving on to chapter 65, entitled Allomance? What do you think?
Allomance,
okay.
Again, Tryon's journal. One of the lines is, "The rebels wanted nothing to do with the governor's letter of terms." And it was so interesting. It was probably, I trust Diana and her research skills. Rebels, when I hear rebel, I think of course, what do you think of?
Rebel?
"We were at a rebel with some rebels on a hot night."
Nope, that's not where I was going.
I was thinking
rebel without a cause, like,
oh,
James Dean.
So revel, the way it's used in Tryon's journal, at least the little excerpt that, I mean, who knows? William Tryon is a historical figure. I'm sure he had lots of letters and writings that are extant that we can see or you can see printed out. I'm not sure if this is one of the actual extant things or if Diana wrote it, you know, in the language, in using language of the time. Because, I mean, it sounded fine. But what she did tell us, whether it was copied from somewhere or whether she wrote it, the word revel is used instead of rebel. Linguistically speaking, B's and V's are very close. To the English ear, it may not sound right, at least to my American English ear, 20th century ear.
Tell me about your other ear, since you have one that's an American English ear. What's the other one?
It doesn't sound right, because I would say rebel, right? I wouldn't say rebel, but that's what it means. It means rebel. I have only one ear, Samalama.
You made it sound like you had more than one.
So with the battle begun and Roger nowhere to be seen, so okay, we know now that we're no longer with Roger, Jaime asks those around him to be on the lookout for Roger. But here we see Jaime really starting to feel bad, like super guilty. Just you wait. That was wrong too, but along those lines. This is Jaime, quote, "They'd find him surely." And, quote, he told himself for the dozenth time, but the reassurance rang as hollow this time as it had before. He knows very well that, quote, "Brianna and Claire would hold him responsible for the man's life
and rightly so, unquote. Kate O. writes, the first time I read the book, I remember thinking, of all the men to send, why Roger?
Uh-huh.
But of course, it had to be Roger. Jaime is respected, but he had to stay with his troops. As son of the house, Roger is the best representative to go. I go back and forth about whether they truly would have blamed him or if this is Jaime's melodramatic sense of family responsibility. Rearing its beautiful redhead. And she writes, I always enjoy when the story is told from Jaime's POV and we get a chance to be in the inner workings of his mind. Even here in the midst of battle, he is relatively calm and working on instinct. The battle giving him the chance or an excuse to stop worrying about Roger for the time being. So speaking of that battle... they're off now,
but you know, lucky for Roger, he didn't have to even be involved in it.
Oh yeah, so lucky Roger. Most of the regulators had actually, I'm not saying most of the group who were there to fight at all anywhere, but the ones who were lined up to fight right in front of Jaime at that moment, most of them ran away once the shooting started because they're like, they're smart. I mean, they're stupid to be there, but they're smart. He and his men slowly move west. When a young man named Hugh comes at Jaime with a knife, Jaime has to protect himself, but he also doesn't want to hurt this dude. Earlier, when those regulators were lined up just before they ran away, he shot above their heads. He does not want to hurt people if he doesn't have to. It's almost comical, or it is comical, this scene with Hugh. Jaime, legit, we all know this, is no one to trifle with. But then Hugh's father-in-law comes to Jaime only to be shot by Jordy Chisholm. It's like, people, if you, number one, know who you're attacking. Number two, like, he's legit not trying to hurt you. They end up all running away. So the men who then started to come after Jordy or around the time Jordy shot, they all ran away. Jaime is able to jump on a man whom he then claims as his prisoner. And it's a really interesting scene there where Jaime is so like the wild Highlander, right? The Scot, the Highlander Scot warrior comes out and he can't even gather the words in English to speak to this man and tell him I'm not going to hurt you or to tell him you're my prisoner, whatever it is. He's speaking and thinking in Gaelic and he's this close to slitting his throat. But he's able to stop himself and calm himself and then gather his mind and get the words in English. And he tells him that he's become his prisoner. And his other men surrounded him. And some of them had gained prisoners as well. But no one had seen Roger. Kate O. writes, from here to the end of the chapter, we see a primal, instinctual, and vicious Jaime. He starts off trying to defuse the situation, as he generally always does. There is no one more logical and black and white than Jaime Fraser. That chain shot, though, unleashes an instinctual need for survival of himself and his men. It is only his extremely strong sense of self that stops him from cutting that man's throat. This fighting of neighbor against neighbor is what I think it must have been like during the Civil War. Having grown up 5 minutes outside of Philadelphia in Bucks County, so often depicted in the Hallmark Channel. Oh, God, that's awesome, Kate. I've always thought of the Revolutionary War as the Redcoats versus first local militias and then the Continental Army. But of course, as Claire pointed out earlier in the book, the Northeast was already well established at this point. Diana showed me a much different POV of the early days of the war. And his first thought after the battle is done is that he takes stock of his men and he's right back to where he was at the beginning of the chapter. Has anyone seen Mackenzie? And then whatever is done now.
He's off snogging some rando. And that ends chapter 65. Moving on to chapter 66. Y'all, there's lots of chapters. 66, entitled A Necessary Sacrifice.
Again from Tryon's journal. The dead were buried. Three outlaws were hanged.
Quote, it was a necessary sacrifice to appease the murmurings of the troops, who were importunate that public justice be immediately executed. So we last saw Roger being attacked, approached by Buck in the water. Now, this chapter opens, he is tied. His wrists and his ankles, wait, yeah, wrists and ankles were tied up with rope, and he was thrown on the ground. And yes, he's struggling to get loose. Remember that flag of truce he was carrying?
Mm-hmm.
They stuffed it down his throat.
Brutal.
Quote, they stuffed it so deep into his throat that he was close to choking. And he has a thought that he will kill Buck. He hears the sounds of the battle. Roger has river water still. Oh, this makes me, good grief. This makes me, yes, there is stuff worse than this, but this makes me think, oh my gosh, like you can almost like, almost imagine like what he was doing in the water. He has river water still in his sinuses.
Blech. No thanks.
They'd pushed his head under the water. Someone from husband's camp was running, I guess running from the camp or running away from the militia, whatever. He was running and he runs by and he sees Roger and he says, this was the guy who came, talked to husband, and then husband told us all to go home and then he left. So this guy did something. He said something to husband. He, it's his fault this is happening. He's because he says, if husband were here, we would have much more, we would have better morale. So he blames this now all on Roger. Buck comes over and asks, what do you mean it's his fault? And the dude says that Roger was a smooth talker and talked to Herman husband and all that. Now, Roger hears the sounds of battle that they have stopped. The regulators had lost. Roger gives this dude, because he's at this point, he's been pulled up. He's standing. And he gives this dude, the dude who said it's his fault, blah, 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 a Glasgow kiss.
With his forehead.
Yep. And then Morag comes over, shocked at what Buck has done to Roger, trussing him up, but happy that her husband is all right because, again, the war.
There?
And she doesn't even like ask. She like bends over. Does she have her own knife or she takes someone else's knife as she tries to start to free Roger from his ropes? And the militia was coming. Morag asks Buck to swear that no harm will come to Roger before she leaves because he's telling her, like, I want you to leave to be, you know, to be safe. He swears. And she's like, not good enough. She brings over her son and says, swear on your son's head.
Exactly.
A man pipes up that they have to leave. He mentions that Tryon wanted to hang prisoners. So next thing we see is that Buck had Roger's Fraser Company badge. So Buck and the dude that Roger had kissed have a plan. He shoves the cloth back into Roger's mouth and goes out to greet the militia. Megan P. writes, poor Roger. This guy can't catch a break. It would be Dougal's and Galus's son that is off his rocker and being a tyrant.
Uh-huh.
I'm sure Jamie will get Roger out of his current predicament. Looking forward to this regulator business being over, though.
Will he, though? Will he?
I think Megan's being a little tongue-in-cheek because I'm sure she's read. It all seems kind of pointless, she writes, hoping to be done with the situation soon. I guess Roger is the sacrifice here? I sure hope not, but you never know. Good chapter. Eugenia E. writes, the whole Roger Morag incident is very complicated. Roger is very reactive. He acts first and thinks later. For the life of me, I don't know what got into Roger when he kissed Morag on the ship, or why he kissed her again when he bumped into her afterwards.
Legitimately stupid. I don't have anything past that.
Is the title of the episode Roger deserved it?
Nah, I don't know that he deserved being like hung, but he was stupid.
Roger stupid?
Stupid. I stand by that 100%.
Roger stupid?
He's stupid.
Eugenia continues. He unleashed the hatred of his ancestor, William Buccleuch Mackenzie, who is a jealous bastard indeed. But Roger's actions were not right. I understand he felt tenderness for Morag and her son, but why did he have to be so expressive?
Because he's stupid. Come on!
Something that really struck me in this chapter is to think that the kerchief that Jamie gives Roger as a flag of truce
ends up being the gag that shuts Roger's mouth. Is this foreshadowing of what ultimately is going to happen to Roger? I don't know.
He should have put it in his own mouth and called it a day.
I don't know. But Roger must have regretted more than once having followed Brianna through the stones. Being wrongly identified once, beaten up to within an inch of his life, and then sold to the Mohawks is a lot to bear. But being deliberately misidentified again, taken away his militia badge by Buckley, and being condemned to death is too much for poor Roger.
All right. Moving on to chapter 68. Chapter 67, entitled Aftermath.
Again, Tryon's journal. Battle done. We cleaned up, treated the wounded, and even helped out the enemy. Good on us. So Claire is back to doctoring. Brianna is helping. Jamie brought her his men and then left to take prisoners to the governor. It's good that Jamie is safe, but boo that there's no word of Roger. And Bree is also wary. People are describing the battle. They mention that Tryon wants to hang leaders of the other side in the field. This freaks out Claire. And this is what I agree with Claire on. Quote, war was bad enough, even when it was necessary. Cold-blooded revenge by the victor was one degree beyond. Unquote. Remember Culloden, anyone? Or should I say after Culloden? Then Jamie returned, but no Roger. He still feels guilty. Quote, his shoulders dropped slightly in discouragement. He's sent word that if Roger is seen anywhere, they will know. Someone will come to them and tell them. Bree is now going with him out to search. Claire is not hopeful. Quote, she felt the counterweight of fear come loose, plunging like a stone into my belly. Unquote. Kate O. writes, with a surgeon's precision, Claire lets us know everything we've missed while we've been off gallivanting in the other POVs. Therein lies the rub. While the regulators are passionate about their cause, the militia members are there because they feel honor-bound to their laird, Jamie. I don't think either side was really prepared to fight each other. And how likely are you to fire upon the enemy when they're not really your enemy? And you may actually agree or understand the reason they're fighting.
They're just your neighbors.
And after all of this is done, they have to go back to living alongside these people.
Seriously. And it's like, I feel bad for Jamie because he doesn't believe what he's fighting for. He's fighting for it because if he doesn't, he loses his land.
Yeah, he actually feels for the regulators.
Right. Even more so in the series because of Duncan. And by Duncan, I mean Murta.
Durta?
Sure.
Or is it Merton? Mergen? I don't know. Thus begins a bit of dark humor. I was going to call it gallows humor, but that's, I think, maybe too apt. This humor begins in this battle. In this after-battle moment, making light of the situation while sitting amidst the blood and guts of the consequences of the battle. And then more foreshadowing. They're hanging the leaders of the regulation.
Moving on to chapter 68, entitled Execution of Orders.
We're back with Roger. Roger woke up in pain. He has no idea what's going on. He hurts everywhere. His vision was not very good. His hands are numb. He's trying to focus his mind on what was going on. He makes sense of a few words, important ones. The word governor was one of them. And then he hears, you are sure? And yes, sir. Someone is saying that they saw Roger at Herman Husband's camp. I mean, that part's true. But they purposefully misidentify him as James McQuiston.
That was very specific.
And then he hears, quote, take him too, then. Three are enough for now.
You, Buckley! I mean that. Spell it how you want to. Cubically is how I feel right now.
They pulled him up and walked him toward a huge white oak tree. He recognizes it as Buck, who'd given him over to them. And then he sees the horses beneath the tree, looped nooses hanging from the branches. Across the clearing, he sees a woman with a child in her arms. He's put on the horse. He tries to arch off the horse. They caught him and they put him back up.
That's not how that works.
The woman gave her child, the woman he sees across the clearing, gives her child to someone else and runs away.
Fucking Morag, man. How is that the only option? How did she not do more than that? For her to stand there long enough to see him getting trotted onto the back of a horse.
Oh, I see. Yeah, she could have left earlier.
Like, seriously.
The noose is dropped around his neck and he screams. And then my last comment was here was, and I'm done. Because I don't need to, there's no more description that needs to be given. Eugenia E. writes, "The first time I read this chapter, I had a bad feeling, but I didn't realize what was going to happen. There is mention of Tryon intending to hang prisoners, 3 hangings to appease the mob. There's an account by one of the men about Tryon's orders to hang the traitors. This really disturbs Claire, and yet I didn't see it coming. Then I read Tryon saying that 3 are enough for now, in front of Roger. And I knew it would be bad. Diana's vivid description of the hanging made me gasp for the air that poor Roger was craving. Like some of you, I thought of Dragonfly and Amber. The description of the official hangman who explains to Claire in detail the perfect technique for a successful hanging.
Boo!
At the end of the chapter, I was really disgusted. These people are like my family." Yeah, she's right. There's more description. Like I said, I'm out. Like that's once it's done and he's hanged, I'm done. I don't need to. You guys can read it. I don't need to. I know it's fiction, but I don't need to glorify. Oh, I can't. It's gross. And it's
a lot.
It's a lot. And it's disturbing. And it's a character whom you love. So it's like it's emotional as well as, you know, disturbing.
Moving on to chapter 69 entitled Hideous Emergency.
Just before Jamie and Bree were ready to leave to go looking for Roger, a young woman was heading for them, running as fast as she could, gasping.
With one shoe.
Yeah, she has one shoe. So homegirl's been like, she doesn't stop to even get her shoe. She's gasping for, she says, Fraser, James Fraser. She's gasping for air and tells them that Roger McKenzie was being hanged by the governor.
It took her long enough.
Somebody, she was out of breath. Stop maligning her.
I'm mad at Morag. She let Roger kiss him. She waited long enough to let him be hung before they had a chance to show up. I have feelings.
And then I wrote, dude, this shit is hard to read. Like, when she said it, and then you know what those characters are, minds are going, I'm just like, ugh. So Bree runs to the, no waiting. Bree is like, done. Bree runs to the horses to go get him, and Jamie follows her. And Claire's like, mother effer. She runs for her horse, leaving Morag vomiting on the ground.
Good.
Claire, and the others too, I suppose, quote, as to the why of it, imagination failed completely, unquote. Jamie's guilt, another example of that, quote, his shoulders were set like stone, braced to bear the burden of knowledge, unquote. Claire's already making plans for the worst to help support Bree and Jem and Jamie in case he's, you know, gone. As they approach the camp, quote, on a rise at the far end of the meadow stood a huge white oak, its spring leaves bright in the slanting sun. My horse moved suddenly, dodging past a group of men, and I saw them. 3 stick figures dangling broken in the tree's deep shadow. The hammer struck one final blow, and my heart shattered like ice. Too late. Unquote.
Too late, but not too late. Depending on what we're saying too late is.
To turn back now.
That's done.
I believe.
You're done. You're good. This is done. We're good. Moving on.
Only one of the men, the 3, had been fortunate to die of a snapped neck. Namely, not Roger. The rope had been new.
I mean, thank God not Roger. Come on.
At this point, Summer, they believe him, he's dead. So they're saying, unfortunately, not Roger, because that means he had a longer, more painful death. The rope not being new
was not new, which meant it was unstretched. So it had more give to it than a professional hangman's noose would have had. Roger, having been taller than the other two men who were hanged, his toes were like touching the ground. They were like dangling in the dust. Quote, his hands had come free. He had managed to hook the fingers of one hand beneath the rope, unquote. Bree and Jamie's reactions are, I couldn't even describe them. Jamie holds him while Bree cuts him. There are no words. Jamie holds him while Bree cuts him down. And then Roger moaned.
What do you think it sounded like?
I'm not going to do that.
Try it. Tell me. Show me. Show me what you think it sounded like.
Bree rushes to cut him down.
Okay.
Claire is doctor once again. She cradles Roger's head as he's brought down to protect his neck. She lets him know, like, you need to bring me aboard. She couldn't tell that he wasn't breathing that she could see, but he had a pulse. She removes the rope, performs mouth to mouth, but there's not much of any movement of his chest going up and down. And he's like, she's like, dang, we must have gotten here relatively super fast.
An hour late.
Yes. Well, late. They got there.
They just did. But come on. His throat was so swollen that her CPR attempts were not successful. She had to cut his throat open so that he could breathe.
They transfer him to a board. She braces his neck. And in order for him to have any chance of surviving, she must perform a cricothorotomy.
Is that different than a tracheotomy?
Tracheotomy. In the end, a tracheotomy is you're cutting open the trachea, right? That's what she did. But she did that. The cricothorotomy, crico is short for, there's a cricoid cartilage. There's thyroid's the gland, right? But there's a cricoid cartilage. And I'm guessing that that's where she cut through to get through the trachea, to the trachea. Or she at least used the cricoid as a landmark to find it, so she knows she didn't go too high, too low, too deep, too left, too right. She does it successfully, and his chest moves.
Which is the opposite of what was happening, which she was trying to blow air into his swollen throat.
Eugenia E. writes, after reading Diana for so long, I have learned that with her, there are not last-minute miracles. BJR raped Jamie. Faith died. Jamie and Claire are separated for 20 years. Culloden happens. Jamie doesn't get to raise his daughter or his son. Brianna gets raped, and so on. Claire always gets into a surgeon's mode, and sometimes I want to stop her. Here, however, I go, go, Claire, go. Slit his throat. Save the poor guy.
Wow. And you know what's so funny is she actually uses that term.
Yeah, she does.
Slitting his throat. And I was like, that's not quite the same thing.
No.
So saying I need to slit his throat is very Sweeney Todd, but that's not what she actually does. Moving on to chapter 70, entitled All Is Well. This is short. Sit tight. It'll be done before you know.
Legit. Like, I have a lot, like one or two lines to say.
Like, don't even close your eyes or take the headphones off for a second because it's about to be done.
Back with Roger's POV, there's blackness comforting him. He opens his eyes, experiences pain, doesn't know what he's seeing, but he believes he sees red hair and he's thinking, is it Brianna? Is it? And then he's like, no, it's Jamie. He knows that he's breathing, he's alive, but he senses that he's breathing through his trachea. And he hears Jamie say, you are alive. You are alive. You are whole. All is well. And then he comfortably sinks back into the blackness. Eugenia E. writes, I want to see this whole section depicted in the series. It is perfectly written, and I know the actors can do an excellent job. I can already picture the scenes in my mind. The cast has proven that they can deliver outstanding performances. Take the reckoning between Lord John and Claire, featured on Blood of My Blood, as an example. However, if the TV adaptation doesn't live up to my imagination, I know I have the book to go back to. I know I'm preaching to the choir.
And we're going to close out this week by finishing chapter 71 entitled A Feeble Spark.
They are in the medical tent. Bree and Roger. Bree and Claire with Roger. Claire is called away because there are other people who need help, yo. And Bree freaks. She's like, you can't leave me. Claire tells her, look, watch his breathing. If he's awake and he can swallow, give him some honey water if he'll drink it.
No, but I feel like you are making it way less stressful than it actually was.
Oh, no, it's stressful.
Yes, Claire 100% said those words. However, being on the receiving end of those words for someone who is not medically inclined is way more than stressful. She has her husband, who is barely on this side of death, laying there. And Claire's like, you're cool. I'm going to go. I'll be back. Just touch him. Talk to him. Make sure you know he knows that you're here. She just cut his throat open and put a whatever in there to make sure he could keep breathing. That's not the same thing. If somebody did a homemade trach on a significant other of mine and said, just sit with him, that's not enough.
But she says to talk to him, he needs to know you're there. He can hear you. And if he opens his eyes, he should be able to see you.
If you lean over him because he can't turn his neck.
Yeah, that's true. Claire says that she's needed elsewhere. And there's nothing that he needs at this moment that Brianna can't do. But absolutely, Brianna, it can't. It's not comforting to hear that, to be left alone. I would be scared poopless too. Kate O. writes, it takes me a moment to reorient myself at the beginning of this chapter. At first, it seems like we aren't taking in the scene from any one specific character's POV, but it slowly shifts to Brianna. So Bree, left alone with Roger, searches for a spot to touch him, where he can feel her, but where she won't hurt him. She lays a hand over his heart and then moves it because she's afraid that too much pressure might cause his heart to stop or make it hard for him to breathe. She's just so scared. Perhaps what's most awful in her mind are his hands. Broken and bloody, nails gone or bloody. Quote, evidence of just how ferociously he had fought to live. Unquote.
I hate these.
I hate it too. And you want to, it reminds me of, I won't talk about the one that people have talked about before. I'm sure you've all heard it about I believe it was concrete, could have been plaster, I don't know, but I believe I have read or heard and probably seen one of the documentaries I've seen about the Holocaust was when Jews or whomever was put in those gas chambers. Obviously
and
you don't
told
see it
they were getting a shower.
Well, yeah, but not you don't see it when it happens. But afterwards, if you go walk through, if you take a tour, if you can tour these places still, you can see where there are nail scratches in the concrete. Yeah. And nothing is worse than the fact of what was done to these people. Don't get me wrong. I am not taking away from that. That was hideous. But to see what's left over from them, oh my God.
What that does is leave an indelible mark. Proving what you know. And knowing something are two different things.
And it just gives you a tiny taste or a big taste, not personally, but secondhand of their absolute terror. So we're here and Diana's describing through the eyes or the mind and eyes of a loved one, the most beloved of this character who we love, who has almost died, and just like evidence of just how ferociously he had fought to live. Because we get enough, like I didn't need to go into, there's no reason for me to describe what Diana described. You can all read it. But it was like, I skipped over some of it. I didn't need to read it. Like, his being aware of, oh Lord, his being falsely accused, being aware of what was happening. Like, yeah, it's a lot. You guys know it's a lot. So that to me is almost harder. Imagining him struggling, knowing he was dying, is almost harder to read than if he had, been killed. Right.
because like if his hands had been tied behind his back or whatever, because he has no chance then.
His hands were tied behind his back.
I think they were in front of him or else he couldn't have.
They were behind his back and they broke free. Like they came untied. His hands were completely.
He had one hand up beneath the rope. Yeah.
Yes. Once he pulled his hands free, like there's a whole thing. Hang on. Let me go back. His hands had come loose, but it was too late. He couldn't feel them. Couldn't manage. His fingers slipped and slid on the twisted strands. So his hands, I thought his hands were tied behind him personally, but either way, his hands were tied and they came loose.
Yeah. Yeah. Either way, he couldn't fight against what was being done to him.
He was bound.
Kate O writes, "You can almost physically feel Brianna's panic here. How many times have we heard her mentally or verbally tell Roger to stay safe or wish him safe? We see her rationalize that he must be stable enough if her mother is willing to leave him to go see other patients. How many times has Brianna felt like this in her life? How many times has she felt that Claire has chosen doctoring over mothering, her patients over her daughter?" Total side note, Kate writes, "Can I ask a serious question? Why does everyone hate Bree?"
Really? Don't start with me on this.
This is Kate. I never got it. In the beginning, sure, she's young and a bit bratty, but I think that's because she lost the parent she was closest to. She loves her mother, and I really think that the book shows her finally getting to know and understand her mother. But Claire was never around. First school, so much school, and then endless hours at the hospital. She basically saw Claire on holidays and special occasions. But she really grows as a character. Why the hate?
Are you wanting me to answer this?
I'm opening up the floor to Summer.
Guys, I feel like the fact that you understood the fact that she's bratty and obnoxious is enough. The fact that you're asking for more than that is kind of annoying, because the thing is that up until not even this book, post this book, and maybe it's up until this book, when this happens, when she kind of has to grow up and stop being completely self-oriented. Because up until this point, yes, she still cares about Jem, and Jem is very important. But up until this point, she's been in this kind of self-revolving existence. She's been caught up in herself, caught up in her own experiences, and the things that only directly impact her. And until this moment, nothing else has trumped her own experiences. After this moment in the book, she begins to become less self-oriented and less self-involved because other things become more important. And up until this part of the book, when we all suffer a loss, I found her completely and utterly annoying. And that will never change, because the past is the past, and my feelings when I read them and I was part of it will always be the same. I think that this experience ages her and makes her more relatable and more, not human, not even, maybe more mature. Maybe that's what I mean.
Sympathetic? No,
I'm still not sympathetic, but she's more mature.
Summer's like, nope.
Don't put words in my mouth. But I think she matures. She begins to mature in this book, for sure. But before this book, done. I'm sorry. I wish I could have cared more about her in the past, but I didn't.
Brianna says to Roger, "Can you hear me? I'm here, Roger. It's me, Bree. Don't worry. You aren't alone." And then she speaks to him in Gaelic.
Which, does he speak Gaelic? Did I miss that part?
Of course he speaks Gaelic.
Okay. No, of course. Don't of course me.
It's from book two, Summer.
Okay.
I'm going to of course that.
Go ahead.
She asks him,
I'm going to of course that. Go ahead.
She asks him how he did this. He laughs. And as she pops out to get something, she says, "Don't you bloody go anywhere, damn you."
Uh-huh.
Kate O writes, The imagery of Brianna grabbing hold of her panic in the form of a snake and burying it away in a basket makes me think of Claire's own gift for compartmentalizing so that she can get to the matter at hand. She wants to follow Claire's advice about touching him, but nowhere seems safe. Every part of him seems fragile or damaged, and she is afraid of hurting him. She's worried that even the weight of her hand on his chest might cease his shallow breath. I have so much empathy for Brianna here as she careens from dark humor, cupping his genitals to let him know she's there,
cup it.
To maternal.
Cup them.
cup it. To maternal, wanting to cradle and nurse him back to health.
She's like, suck my boob. Suck my boob while I cup your tit. And I'm totally being maternal.
While I cup your tit?
Cup my tit. Well, like, no.
That's not what you're
right. I didn't. I'm going to cup your balls while you do something with my tit.
There you go.
Sorry. I'm back.
Yes.
We're good.
There you go.
Go ahead.
From to maternal to fury. How in God's name did you do this?
Exactly.
Hissed in his
tell her,
ear.
Tell her what you did, Roger. You made out with some dude's husband, wife.
You're on a roll tonight, Sam.
A little bit.
Well, Brianna, he did this by being, and yes, I'm going to bleep myself. Brianna, he did this by being a f***ing idiot.
That's please don't bleep it. Please leave it.
I have to.
Say it 100% like that.
I bleep all words like that.
Unless you don't, where you bleep words that are not curse words and you leave it like, whoops.
That's my biggest issue with this general plot point. Obviously, this is what Diana wanted to happen and it leads Roger down a totally new path in life, but I just feel like, why?
A new path in life. What the fuck? It totally leads Roger down a new mute path in life where he can't do literally fucking anything that he used to do. He becomes less than, and that's all he can be because he's broken.
It's like Roger's sense of self has been slowly chipped away since Brianna entered his life. Whoa. And now the last thing that gives him some sense of who he is in this world, his music, his singing, is gone.
It's gone. Good night.
His laughing at the end of the chapter signifies two things for me. One, the fact that she is outright and justly angry at him makes him know he's going to be okay. If she was still coddling him and being sweet, he'd be worried. This comes up later too with another couple, but I'll keep it at that. Two, he knows this all happened because he was an idiot.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, all the comments are completely supporting Summer's hypothesis.
They should, because he's stupid. Like, the things he does in the preceding chapters that led to this moment were dumb, and even he knew it. Like, when you go back and read it, he's like, I don't know, or not, he's not, because it's not inside of his head, because it's all third person, but it's like, Roger did blah, 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 and all the things are like, he didn't even think about it. It wasn't even something he considered. He just acted. It wasn't with no forethought. All those things imply that he's 100% being a f***ing idiot. 100%.
Summer,
and then they hung him because
I'm gonna
of
have
it.
I think this is gonna have more bleeps than any other episode.
Do it. I'll keep cursing if I need to. I'm mad. I'm mad that I had to read this. I'm mad that it hurt my feelings when I read it, even though I've read it so many times over the years and I knew it was coming. But I'm mad. I'm mad that he made this happen. And I'm mad at Diana for making him make this happen. Ugh. I feel that way. Roger, moving on. Please join us next time.
Is that the title of this episode?
Maybe it is. Roger.
Okay.
And that was chapter 71. Join us next week when we will be discussing a bunch of chapters, y'all. We're going to start with 72 entitled Tinder and Char. Moving on to chapter 73, A Whiter Shade of Pale. 74, The Sound of Silence. 75, Speak My Name, which is a lot like Beyonce's Say My Name. Say my name, say my name. And finishing it up with chapter 76 entitled Blood Money. And if you'd like to join us to continue the conversation, please come to www.outlanderpod.com/groups and join us on our Facebook page.
We'd love to have you as part of our Patreon community. You can read more about that
at patreon.com/outlanderpod. And we are every so often adding more perks to being a supporter of us, of the podcast on Patreon. And we'd love to have you. Thank you as always so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode.
Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at OutlanderPod.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's,